Hello and welcome back to issue 47 of Double Reel, the monthly magazine podcast for the discerning film nerd. My name's James Adamson. I'm here to regale you with nerdy chat about films and the world of cinema generally. I'm joined as always by my co-host, also called James Adamson. Welcome, James.
Hello, it's good to be back.
Last week we brought you the first part, Double Reel Monthly, with news, reviews of new releases and chat about how we're fitting film watching into our busy, exciting lives. If you haven't heard it yet, please do go back and download it, where you'll find reviews of new and recent films, including Dune Part 2, The Zone of Interest, Madame Web and The Kitchen. We also discussed the latest film in my new year-long project featuring women directors, which is Chloe Zhao's Nomadland, and the latest film in James's Year of the Nolan project, where he looked at Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight Rises. We followed that up with the latest edition of the Penalty Shootout film quiz. Just to mention again, if you're enjoying the pod, we'd be very grateful if you take a couple of minutes to give us a five-star review wherever you get your podcasts.
Now it's time for our regular features, and our theme this month is Asian cinema. We start with classics and recommended, where we dip into our list of great films we haven't got round to seeing yet. For this episode, it's the disturbing Japanese horror film Audition.
Our hidden gem looks at lesser known or underappreciated films that deserve a wider audience, which this month features the Cold War thriller Steel Rain.
Then it's The One That Got Away, where we look at projects that filmmakers tried and failed to bring to the big screen. This time we look at Wong Kar-wai's unsuccessful attempt to make an international film with The Lady from Shanghai.
We close our features episode with the remake Hate Watch. This month we look at the questionable decision to make a Hollywood English language version of the Korean classic Old Boy.
Next week it's The Big Conversation, where we discuss the topic from the film world in more detail. We'll tell you more about that a bit later.
First, let's just have a look at some of the messages we've received from listeners, aka the reader's letters. Our classic, as James said, is Audition. And Claire says, it's almost a film of two halves. The first half centres around a romance between a widowed man and a beautiful, mysterious woman. Then from halfway through, it turns into something much more dark and disturbing. It's not as gory as I thought it would be from its reputation, and maybe I'm in the minority, but I was hoping for a bit more blood and guts. Stephanie, on the other hand, says, I remember seeing it 20 years ago and being completely freaked out by it. It's been surpassed by other films, though, in the intervening period of torture porn and gory horror. Our hidden gem is Steel Rain, and Warren says, this is great stuff if you like a nuclear spy thriller. I enjoyed the race against time while the tensions escalated between North and South Korea. Cammy says, not seen it, but based on that plot summary, I'll give it a go. And that is literally what this feature is for, so great to hear, Cammy. On The One That Got Away, Wong Kar-wai's The Lady from Shanghai, Ho Shin says, it will probably never get made, but it would be great if it did. Margot Robbie would be perfect casting as the main character if they were going to do it now, which is a great shout, I have to say. Remake Hate Watch, the US version of Old Boy. I can barely say those words. Stephen says, I watched this because it became available on Netflix here in the US, and wow, did it stink. April says, this got a lot of hate because people just instinctively don't like remakes, and I know the original is a classic, but I saw the US version first and really liked it. It left me speechless at the end. Michael says, the US remake is possibly the worst film I've ever seen, messed up literally every aspect of the original and added nothing new. We're also going to talk about whether we could do whether there should be a remake of an old film called Revenge of the Ninja. And Tommy just said it when I posted that up, you're right that most ninja films are crap, but there has been some decent anime like Ninja Scroll, which is interesting to add. Thank you, Tommy. Thanks for all your messages. It's always great to hear from you. Now on with the pod. Now for the classics and recommended feature, where we try and watch something from our backlog of great films instead of the endless movie repeats rotating on TV. Our watch list includes films one or both of us haven't seen before and recommendations from you, the audience. Committing to do so for this feature has helped break the mental block around some of these films. I mean, we got to see and share our thoughts on a wide range of films, from Korean zombie thriller Train to Busan to Louisiana Gothic Eve's Bayou. We have a growing list of other films to do for this feature as we keep adding films we haven't seen yet, and from the steady stream of audience recommendations. You can go to letterboxd.com/doublereel and click watch list for all the films on our list, and you can make recommendations there or all the usual places on our socials. This month we have another theme in which all of our features are drawn from Asian cinema. We start with a highly rated, some would say notorious, psychological thriller slash horror film, which is not for the squeamish and was a big influence on Western filmmakers like the Saw series and Eli Roth's Hostel. The classics and recommended feature for issue 47 is Takashi Miike's Audition. So, just quickly as a little preface for our theme. We've said that the theme this month is Asian cinema. What comes to mind for you, James, normally when someone says Asian cinema? Because that's a big old continent, isn't it?
Yes, so just because it was the first film I ever saw that was Asian cinema, it would either be, well, there's two actually, the first two films I saw would either be Spirited Away or Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Now, that's obviously an anime slash Studio Ghibli type film, and the other one's like a kind of ancient medieval kind of Chinese film.
Yeah, but in there you've got anime and you've got like the wuxia sort of action films. So they're two pretty solid pillars of the genre, yeah, you could say.
But like you know, Western cinema or American, British or whatever cinema, you can have animated films, you can have films set in medieval periods, and then you can have zombie films like Train to Busan or just like kind of social commentary films like Parasite. So I think you probably think of the most popular ones or the most successful ones, but when you look at it, they make films in Asia that are just, you know, like us. They're starting to get more attention now. I think back in the day, so to speak, you'd only ever hear of films like Seven Samurai or, you know, the kind of, you know what I mean? Like the
it was a lot more niche. And I mean, the reason Seven Samurai was as popular in the West as it was, I mean, I love Kurosawa. You weren't so keen on Seven Samurai. It's a very old film. Is that Kurosawa was influenced by John Ford Westerns and then did it in a Japanese setting. So it was pretty easy for a less converged world to go, oh, right, Japanese film. I get that. Do you know what I mean? The plot engine was familiar. But the world's a lot closer together now, so Asian cinema is just there at a touch of a button, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think now people don't just look at Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and Hero and House of Flying Daggers and the kind of popular films. It's now, oh, there's films like Parasite and Train to Busan and, you know, all these different types of films like just that we would expect to be made in Hollywood or in British or European cinema that, you know, it's just about people's lives.
Yeah, and they've always been there, but now we get to see them as well. Now, obviously, we're being very focused here on East Asian cinema in our theme, so apologies for that. I think we're going to need to come back in the future. I mean, you've got, you know, you have the cinema of Iran is pretty popular. You have Indian cinema. You have all sorts of stuff from, you know, a massive continent that constitutes, you know, something like half the world's population. But, you know, we're using that as a bit of a shorthand, maybe a little bit American influence in the way we've used the word Asian there. But, you know, the films that we're doing, that they're kind of Japanese, Chinese, Korean, that kind of thing. An audition fits into something that you used to get. I think it was Tartan Video used to do. It was called Asia Extreme. And it tended to be like a way of going, oh, there's some pretty sort of mad stuff out there, you know, tougher action, gorier, you know, literally more extreme stuff than you might get in Hollywood cinema. Not every film that they put out kind of fit that. Like Infernal Affairs was put out on Asia Extreme. I think that could be a Michael Mann film, you know, and then it was in the end a Scorsese film. But, you know, I think there was this strand of it called Asia Extreme where it was like not just gore, but sort of taking you places, like Old Boy, taking you places to dark, perverse, twisted places that you love and sort of mess with your mind in a way that we don't sort of normally see Western cinema as doing. And I think Audition fits into that for me. But for you, I mean, when I suggested Audition for the pot, I mean, had you even heard of Audition? Was it on your radar?
No, it's a very, you know, niche, small film. Like, when I was reading up about it, it made barely any money at the kind of global box office. So it's definitely hidden away.
Yeah, and so, I mean, just it's out, you know, it's 25 years old. It's very much out of your frame of reference. But I guess you read up on it and sort of heard about, you know, the film's reputation.
Yeah. The listener message, was it from Claire?
Yeah.
She said that she was expecting a lot of gore, so that is obviously something that the first thing that you see about it is that it is a kind of creepy horror type film.
Yeah, I mean, I've been aware of this film for something like 20 years, because I think there was a time, especially in the early 2000s, where that Asian cinema was being championed by people like Tarantino. Tarantino's gone, I've seen Battle Royale, it's an incredible film. You know, there's an Asia Extreme, you know, film, which we've already done on the pod, to be fair. But Asian cinema generally, there's just some great stuff out there. And then for Kill Bill, Tarantino had Sonny Chiba and all of these people from films that he loved in there. And that's always been a bit of a thing, because John Carpenter, when he did Big Trouble in Little China, part of his influences were he loved those Chinese films, and Hong Kong cinema like John Woo had already sort of crossed over a little bit. But Audition was one of these films that, you know, if you follow the cinema of Japan and Korea, it would be mentioned, usually followed by the phrase, fucking hell, because that's its reputation. And I think the first time I was fully aware of this was when Hostel came out. Now, I'm not sure what your views are on like the films like Saw and Hostel and that kind of torture porn horror that became popular in the 2000s.
Not really my thing. I think that's a bit excessive.
Not me either. There's something about that kind of being trapped, like strapped to a chair while people spend a long time doing horrible things, that you just think, it's just not for me. But I remember when Hostel came out and people were like, what the fuck is this? And I'm still not a fan of Eli Roth. But Tarantino's friends with Eli Roth. And he said something like, yeah, when Eli Roth told me about the film he was doing, he says, oh yeah, you're doing your Takashi Miike film. And I went, okay, what does that mean? And I found Audition. I went, all right, I see it now. While Audition, I think, is very different from those films, it's clearly been an influence on a strand of cinema over here in the West. And that's kind of how I came to know it. Takashi Miike's had a pretty varied career. I've discussed a couple of his films on the pod, like 13 Assassins and Blade of the Immortal. He's directed like over 100 films. The guy's mental. He does 3 films a year. And they're not small films. Most of his productions are quite elaborate. I do not know how he does it. He literally cannot possibly be taking like holidays or time off.
Yeah, I mean, he's just afters in Japan, so I'm not surprised.
Oh, hell yes. Oh, hell yes. He just makes film after film after film. And not every film he does is like this Audition. I mean, 13 Assassins is, you know, definitely tougher action than you'd normally get. Blade of the Immortal is based on a graphic novel and has a similar kind of that, you know, otherworldly vibe to its source material. He does all sorts, but I think he does have a reputation for, you know, Audition and Ichi the Killer for like, well, Takeshi Miike, oh, bloody hell. And he just has that reputation of being capable of some pretty dark content. So you were aware of the film from reading up on it. You were aware that it was kind of, you know, had that gooey reputation. What were your thoughts as the film started and unfolded? Talk me through how that film seemed to you as it began.
I quite like the premise of it. I find especially with Japanese films that the premises are a little bit kind of wacky, but also not entirely unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the premise is the guy is setting up a phony audition to meet a love interest, because he's a widow, and his wife said, his son says, look, you need to get a new wife, you know, pull your finger out kind of thing. And I kind of like the concept of that. It's creepy, and it's weird, and it's very, you know, it's, I kind of got Stockholm Syndrome vibes from it. But I thought, yeah, I'm on board with this story. And then he meets someone, and she has a dark past, and the story sort of goes from there.
Yeah, it's a pretty slow build-up, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's a lot of kind of like, well, what's this kind of background to her? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, this film, that premise could have gone in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't think either of us are big rom-com fans, but you could have used a rom-com out. I mean, Sleepless in Seattle is basically the same premise, where the son looks at Tom Hanks and says, Dad, you need a wife, right?
Yeah.
So, And I mean, it's weird looking back at that premise, because someone who works in film, you know, who's a film producer or works in film production, you know, tricking actresses into coming to do an audition so that he can kind of get their phone number and chat them up. It's not quite Weinstein, but it's the sort of thing that would. It's interesting that he was doing that in 1999 when that sort of thing was going on, but it wasn't as much of a big part of the public consciousness as it is now, post-Me Too. I mean, how's that premise aged for you in terms of that? That's a bit weird, what that guy's doing.
I mean, yeah, it's certainly believable, especially in light of the whole kind of the Weinstein stuff. And that's sort of what I liked about it, because it was like, yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard to know, because the film keeps its cards close to its chest for so long, doesn't it? For the plot, it gradually unfolds that what's going on with the female character. And it very slowly kind of, You do get a few flashbacks later on as well with the male lead about what was going on in his past and what he's going on about. So it's not very clear where the sympathies of the film lie. So there's kind of two questions really, isn't there? One is, the first one is, when a guy sets that idea up, how sympathetic are you to him when you're going, it's a bit creepy, mate, what you just did. How sympathetic are you to it as he starts to gradually get caught up in the web of this film?
Yeah, you don't really have a lot of sympathy for the guy. Well, I didn't, because what he's done is it's sort of like, it's misleading, and it almost feels like it's sort of trying to trap someone into being his wife.
Yeah, I mean, the rom-com version of this is that it turns out later she finds out that the whole thing was a setup, and it's they break up and he has to run through the rain and apologise. Do you know what I mean? I can see that version of this film being made. You know how, like, there's a... I'm completely stealing this from the rewatchables, by the way. I do apologise to them. I know they listen. Hi, Van. Hi, Bill. But they're talking about... Have you seen on YouTube, there's like a trailer of The Shining recut to pretend it's like a wholesome family comedy?
No, but that sounds funny.
Yeah, no. Jack Torrance just took his family to a hotel for the winter. Do you know what I mean? So, like, you could cut a trailer of Audition that makes it look like a rom-com. So I agree. What do you think about the Takeshi Miike wrote and directed this? What do you think he thinks of his main character? Do you think his main character is? Do you think he's sympathetic to his main character, or do you think he's going, this is a cautionary tale, mate, you got yourself into this?
Yeah, I think it's almost like it kind of serves you right.
So that's interesting, because I mean, this is much debated. The director's intentions are much debated. The other thing is, as with all these things, horror films, especially psychological thrillers, but especially anything where somebody's dark past is revealed, there's always a risk, isn't there, that you go, mate, don't do it. There's obviously something wrong here. Why are you going on a date with her? This is crazy. You know, you're an idiot for getting yourself caught up in this. And it's a fine line that any film like this treads that says the truth has to be unveiled or has to unfold just in the right way so that you could believe the main character wouldn't just run screaming and the film's over, you know, run away, get out, you know, like, don't go into that dark house. That's a terrible idea, you know? So what do you think about how the film unfolded? Can you understand why someone wouldn't immediately kind of see a red flag?
I think that's the kind of reason the guy was a widower. Like, he was written to be that type of character. He's a bit vulnerable, and he's kind of been pressured by his son, and maybe he overlooked or didn't look as thoroughly into the people, and specifically a Sammy, when conducting his fake audition. So maybe that's why he was a bit naive, because he's obviously in that state of mind where he's just suffered a loss, and he's sort of grieving, and he's trying to maybe kind of fill a hole that is there with anything or the nearest thing, maybe. I think that's probably why he didn't clock on as quickly as he should have.
Yeah. The other thing about this film is that all the things that this film is famous for happen in at least the second half of the film, don't they? So the film has to kind of keep you going along to kind of go, okay, little revelation, or something's not right, little revelation, until eventually the true horror of the situation unfolds. What did you think of the pacing of this film and how long it takes you to... There's a pivotal moment in the film involving a sack on the floor. I don't want to spoil it too much for people who haven't seen it. But there's at that moment, that's when you really go, oh, the situation is really fucked. And it's quite a while before that happens. What did you think of the pacing and how it unfolded?
It was weird. I'm surprised to see that this film is only about an hour and 45, hour and 50 minutes long. Because it did feel like a bit of a slow burner. But I think as soon as that pivotal scene happens, it changes very quickly to kind of, oh shit, and it descends into complete chaos.
Yeah, there are hints before that, aren't there? But it does take a while. I mean, you know, were you getting impatient?
A little bit, but probably more from the fact that this film isn't my type of thing, more than the actual pacing of a story that I was interested in.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't mind the pacing of Oppenheimer or The Wolf of Wall Street or Killers of the Flower Moon, just to name three relatively recent long films because I was keen to watch them, whereas this, don't know if I was impatient because I wanted to know more or I was just impatient because it wasn't my thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I get it. Once it does kick in, I mean, after those little hints that all is not well, and the woman that he's going on dates with, I mean, it's like most psychological thrillers, because it's kind of like a psychological thriller that turns into a horror film, isn't it? And most of those sorts of films, going back to Hitchcock, there's a level of complicity, isn't there? The audience is complicit, because, like, you know, Quentin Tarantino told you this was gory, and yet you still watched it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if you don't like how this film pans out, you kind of you knew beforehand what you were going to get, kind of. There's a complicity for the main character, because when his son says, you need to find yourself a wife, I know Match.com or Tinder doesn't exist back then, but he could have gone on a date. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He could have gone to a dating agency, and things unfold where you find out about other aspects of his personal life with his co-workers. I don't think he's guilty of harassment or anything, but also I don't think he's necessarily treated women all that well, and I don't think he's treated women in this process all that well. So there's a level of complicity in these films which is natural, which is to say, if the guy led a blameless, completely blameless life, the situation wouldn't happen and you wouldn't have a movie. So you have that engine driving him into this danger. And then, you know, you have this woman unfolding with a little hint drop into it. Once it kicks into gear, though, it's like, yeah, there's some serious trouble here. This is just going to get worse and worse and worse. The tension's meant to ratchet up. It builds. It uses a lot of horror film tropes, like the isolation of the main characters and the way it shoots it. Did you find it effective? I know this isn't your kind of film, but how did it work for you once it kicked into gear?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not into the kind of torture porn type of film, but the film definitely picks up and is more engaging after that scene with the sack, which sounds very weird to say as a sentence, but as soon as that happens, you go, oh, who the fuck is this? You know, a Sammy character, what's her past? And from there, you're like, oh, fuck, now there's a bit of trouble. I think that scene could have maybe happened 15 to 20 minutes before.
Yeah.
But maybe, I think, definitely the director wanted to kind of build up a little bit more to kind of establish the kind of relationship between the two.
Yeah,
if you rushed that, maybe he felt that it wouldn't have been as effective for that twist.
It takes a lot of confidence, doesn't it, to kind of hold, you know, keep your powder dry for that long, doesn't it? So, yeah, and then, obviously, we've been holding off almost as long as the film has, getting to the point. As the film sort of reaches its climax, the balance of power completely shifts, and it turns out that the woman is a pretty terrifying person who subjects the man to a terrifying ordeal, which the guy is, absolutely, scarred and traumatized. And I don't want to play out how it ends, but this is a life or death situation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, are we keeping it completely spoiler free?
I think, if I may,
the pivotal scene basically kind of unravels, without getting into it, that this woman, like you've just said, is absolutely fucking batshit crazy mental. So from that point, he's completely in danger, and that's when the gory bit starts.
And his family's in danger. The whole thing is this is not punishment. This is potentially execution that he's headed into. I don't want to spoil how the film ends up, but it's a pretty sustained attack towards the end, isn't it? The final third is grim. I was gritting my teeth and kind of looking away a couple of times as she takes him on, and launches her attack on him.
And yes, it is pretty graphic. There's, he basically gets restrained without kind of explaining why, and he's basically subject to some pretty nasty stuff.
And given its reputation, and then what actually happens? Was it as gory as you expected? Was it as absolutely full on insane as you expected?
I think if I'd watched it, I would have gone, Jesus Christ, that's probably the most gory film I've ever seen. But because I did that reading, and it's like anything that you kind of hear about, read up on, not necessarily to do with gore. Like, for example, I didn't like Pulp Fiction because it's one of your favorite Tarantino films, one of your favorite of all time. You absolutely loved it. I watched it and wasn't as impressed.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start reading, it's this gore fest, it's torture porn, etc. You're like, oh, fucking hell, I'm in for one here. So it was definitely very, 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 very graphic and very gory, but the way it was discussed, I was expecting, you know, an hour and 45, say, of just absolute, you know, gore, basically. But it's similar probably to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Not a lot of action slash gory stuff happens for about 2.5 hours, and then the last 15, 20 minutes are absolutely mental.
Yeah, and it's whether you buy into the build-up and the world that you've been given to watch. Yeah, the thing that freaked me out, I mean, obviously the gore is the gore and everything else, but I'll tell you what was really creepy about it was the way she sort of sings to herself while she's torturing him.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Jesus. That's... because, you know, if you don't speak Japanese and then a perfectly nice Japanese woman walks past you singing to herself, that it would remind you of that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But what about the fact that this film has the legacy that it has? I mean, is it? Do you think people miss the point when they make films like Saw and Torch, Saw and Hostel, based on, you know, partly inspired by what they've seen in this film? Has this film's imitators, as so is often the case, missed the point?
I mean, maybe not necessarily the point, because the Saw and Hostel films want to take that kind of graphic nature of the audition into their own films. But the whole point of the audition wasn't just the gore. It was, there's gore in this film, but the story is completely different, and gore becomes a kind of part of the interaction between the two characters, or the kind of relationship between the two characters. So maybe you not missed the point, but perhaps those Saw and Hostel films are just pure gore. Saw is people being punished for their sins by Jigsaw, so he puts them through these horrible traps and, you know, trials type things. And Hostel, I've never seen Hostel, I've got no interest in seeing it, but it's, I imagine it's similar.
It's just a sustained attack. I mean, the first Saw film is a lot more interesting than its sequels, in the sense that you get this element of, you know, you've put yourself in this situation kind of thing, similar to something like Seven. But yeah, more interesting for me is actually what the director's true intentions are on this, because there's a hell of a lot of debate about whether this film is misogynist or feminist. As in, is Takeshi Miike saying, don't go on a blind date because women are mental? Or is Takeshi Miike saying, you know what, if women ever actually took the revenge that they deserve to take on men, say in Japan, because he's writing about Japanese culture and Japanese, you know, male and female relations, that if you know, if a woman did this, that there's a few men out there who wouldn't entirely be, you know, who wouldn't entirely be undeserving, kind of thing. What do you think his intentions were in that sense?
I mean, it's hard to say without the guy himself, you know, saying it, but I never got the kind of vibe of women are mental. It's more kind of like, be careful, you know.
This person is mental, yeah.
Don't do this kind of shady fake audition and not expect there to be no consequences for what you're doing. I think it's more, don't try and get away with being a creep, as opposed to
women are mental. Yeah, I thought there was an interesting line. I don't know if you picked up on this, that, because obviously the son is more assertive than the dad in a lot of ways. The son's the one saying, you know, dad, you just sit at home doing nothing. Although we do find out that he's had, you know, other relationships which, you know, don't set him in a very good light. But his son says, look, you're just fading away. You're wasting your life. Go out, get out there. So his son's quite assertive in that way. But there's a scene sort of partway through the film where the dad's asking the son about the son's girlfriend, and the son's not sure about the relationship. And he says something like, I'm scared of women. They're so complicated. I thought that was an interesting line to have in the film. And it's by the son, not the father. I thought that was interesting about, is he basically saying that sort of Japan, I mean, because, you know, the background to this at the moment is there's a lot of Japanese people are not having relationships these days, and people are asking whether Japanese men and women relate to each other very well. But I thought that was an interesting comment, that maybe Japanese men struggle with women. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Maybe, yeah.
But then, you know, the people have said, yeah, but if you spend the whole film talking about this woman being terrifying and horrible and just basically becoming the kind of typical horror movie, like, antagonist where, you know, you've got to defend yourself against them, it's kind of, you know, it's you know, and then, you know, and people should judge for themselves about where the film ends, about what they've done. But I think it's interesting, and I think Takeshi Miike's principal intention was to be provocative, and I think he certainly succeeded in that.
Yeah, definitely.
And now for the hidden gem feature about a film that is not as well known or as appreciated as it deserves to be. We aim to bring an overlooked and underrated film to your attention and say why this deserved to have more critical and commercial success than it got, and why you should watch it or reevaluate it. This month we continue our Asian cinema theme with a tense thriller set in the continuing Cold War between North and South Korea, which despite being widely available is not that widely seen. The hidden gem for issue 47 is Steel Rain. We mentioned this on the pod before. I went back and looked at episode 10. I talked about having seen it as part of our, you know, what we called the roundup at them, which was Double Room Monthly. The reason this is a hidden gem is that if you look on IMDb for Steel Rain, I mean, because it's outside of Korea, it was distributed on Netflix, so it's not very easy to see the box office or anything. It was a pretty decent hit in Korea, but its rating is 7.1 in IMDb, so it's not like completely underrated by you know users, but the number of ratings it's got on IMDb is 6,500. Now I know it's a big film that everybody's talking about, but Dune Part 2 has got 256,000 ratings on IMDb, so a lot fewer people have seen this than have seen like big Western films. So that's why I've got it down as a hidden gem. That, and when I watched it, I liked it. Had you seen it before I nominated it for the Asian Cinema Month, mate?
No, I hadn't, though.
Yeah, I listened back to what I said about it at the time. I think the things that had stayed with me when I first watched it were the action thriller element. There's a shootout, there's an airstrike at the start of the film and all of that stuff. This time I was struck more by the Cold War espionage suspense element of it, because it is a Cold War thriller. It is a spy behind enemy lines trying to avert disaster. Plot summary, for those who aren't aware, the North Korean military intelligence agent, central character of the film, is ordered by his commanding officer to go to a factory opening event on the border between North and South Korea and assassinate a senior member of his own government to prevent a coup. That the coup is intended to kill the leader of North Korea. When he gets there, there's a big parade, lots of North Korean civilians and Chinese dignitaries and the North Korean leader. Then, instead of the coup attempt that he's expecting, some other North Korean military agents hijack a US helicopter gunship, fly in and bomb the event with these terrifying and horrendous Steel Rain missiles of the title, massacring almost everyone and seriously wounding the North Korean leader. North Korean agent realizes something is up, and he takes the unconscious leader and two surviving teenage girls who happen to be there across the border into South Korea on the quiet, in the hope that it's safer there, and then to work out what to do next. Down in the South, it's just been an election. One president's on his way out and a new one's about to take office. There's a lot of plot, so bear with me. The assassination attempt and coup leads to an escalation between North and South Korea. The new president is eager to be assertive and not let this stand. The Americans are saying it would be cheaper to nuke the North and have a full-scale conventional war, so there's a possible nuclear strike on North Korea. And the escaping North Korean agent and an advisor to the old president, who's stuck there thinking smells a rat, they team up to try and stop all that war breaking out on the Korean peninsula, despite not entirely trusting each other because they're on opposite sides of the Cold War. And, you know, action ensues. What are your thoughts on Cold War thrillers generally, mate? That means something different in the West than in Korea, doesn't it?
They're okay.
It's not a very current thing for you, is it? You didn't live through it.
No, I mean, I've seen Bridge of Spies, and it might sound daft, but I've played Call of Duty Black Ops, which, you know, goes into kind of the details behind the Cold War era. But for me, at the end of the day, it was a Cold War. Now, that's not to kind of, you know, play down the significance of the events, because it was probably the most important events of, you know, the last century and probably all time, given the kind of consequences of it or the potential consequences of it. But not a lot of kind of action happens. It was already done in the shadows, hence Cold War. You know, they were at war with each other, but there was no one fighting on the battlefields. It was all kind of, will it ever come to a head? So for me, the they're a little bit kind of non-starters for me.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. And the thing is, when you live through it at the time, stuff like the Cuban Missile Crisis and other things, that threat of nuclear war was probably the biggest kind of ratchet to the tension. Yeah. And I think some, you know, some Cold War thrillers, certainly the plot of a couple of Bond films from the Cold War era were, you know, if we don't defuse this atomic bomb, this is gonna lead to all out war kind of thing. That was a, you know, it's like the Cold War was like a bit of a constant, so that you would get a lot of spy thrillers with people on both sides just almost perpetuating this kind of, as you say, like secret sort of intrigue. And then the possibility of escalation would be, oh shit, we need to team up and stop because this could kill everybody kind of thing. And I think that Cold War nuclear escalation is definitely the ratchet here. But it's interesting that the Cold War is a pretty current thing for everyone in North and South Korea, isn't it? Because they've never stopped being in one since the 1950s. What did you think of the tension between the two countries and how it's portrayed in this film?
Yeah, I found that quite realistic. And they're obviously the best people to kind of portray it because, you know, it's still going on and I don't think it'll stop in the foreseeable future. But yeah, I mean, I suppose it's different in for North and South Korea because, like you say, they're still going through it. But the kind of Cold War films in general, you know that, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, you know, didn't result in any, you know, catastrophic consequences. Do you know what I mean? So for me, if you're going to go for a plot where we sort of know what already happens, I'm not on board with that. But what this film does, what I'm trying to say is if there was a film about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know that nobody's going to get killed by the nuclear bomb.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The tension might be tense, but there's no threat.
Because you know how it ends. You don't know how this one ends. Because you could imagine this... someone in Korea watching this and going, yeah, there's a presidential election next year, this could happen next year, is, I guess, the intention of the filmmaker.
Yeah, so for me, it was... what they did was quite effective because they sort of speculate what could happen. So, for you know, in this, spoiler alert, at the end, nuclear missiles do get fired.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about sort of... what happens then, you know, when do other nations get involved? How do they approach this before it becomes an absolute fucking shit fest?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's probably the best spoiler without a spoiler you've ever done, mate. That's really cool because for the people listening, James has given you a plot detail, but he hasn't spoiled the plot. That's just enough for you to know that it gets pretty fucking serious in this film, right?
Yeah, so that's what's effective about this is because it goes beyond... It's not trying to tell it as if it's like... obviously, it's a work of fiction, but it's not trying to tell it as if this has happened. It's saying, look, this could happen.
And this could really ratchet up.
I think that's how you approach things like Cold War films. Like, you know, Watchmen does what if Richard Nixon had a third term as president type thing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot going on, isn't there? There's a lot of political context to explain. And I guess even though this was, I assume, primarily aimed at a North Korean audience because it was released in the cinema there. South Korean audience. South Korea always has one eye on, you know, South Korea does look around at the rest of the world and think about its global audience. And I do feel like they took a little bit of time to explain the different parts of what's going on, didn't they?
Yeah.
Was that? I mean, did they take too long over that? Was it all right? They had to explain a fair bit, but
yeah, it did feel very expositional. But I think out of sort of necessity, and I think that's, you know, for like you say, when you're releasing a film that's going to be put on Netflix and watched by a global audience, you kind of have to do that because there's so many things that you know you just have to explain to people that don't really have any idea what is going on. If it was just released in South Korea, they could have maybe shaved off a good chunk of the film.
Because people would have just known that. You know, there's a little bit...
This is the president, this is the chief of staff kind of thing, so, you know, they don't need to explain the sort of background to what's going on with them type thing. But for us, for people that have no idea what goes on in the country, I'm watching Shogun on Disney Plus right now.
Oh, I've heard that's really good. Is that really good?
It's very good. Obviously, it's a TV show, and it's brilliant, but there is a lot of, like... There's an Englishman in it, and he's almost the viewer. So every single thing about, you know, tradition in Japan and every translation and that is sort of spoon-fed to us. It's done very well, but
you know, if they'd just done it in Japanese without any explanation, it probably, you know, wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I know. Funnily enough, there's another show called Shogun. I don't think they're at all related to each other because it is a completely different thing. But back in the 80s, Richard Chamberlain, the king of the 80s miniseries, was in a film called Shogun about a Western man who goes to Japan.
No, it's pretty much that.
Really?
Yeah, it's...
I wonder if it's a formal remake. Sorry, we're digressing
a bit, but quick tangent. There's an English merchant who crashes in Japan and ends up helping one of the regents because
that's an actual remake. Interesting.
It is Shogun. Yeah, from the 80s.
And I think it's a justified remake because I think they can do stuff now. Notwithstanding, they were able to use Toshiro Mifune back then, but now that still. Anyway, sorry for the digression, folks. That's just me getting watching tips from James. So there was an interesting bit where it tells you that point about you know the exposition that's required. There's a couple of minutes where someone's giving a talk to Korean students talking about the history of Korea, and how it was, you know, under Japanese influence, so they're not entirely happy about now being under American influence. But because they didn't gain their independence by themselves and fuck the Japanese off without American help, they kind of got stuck with American like influence in their country, and they're just kicking against that a little bit. It reminded me of like the East Germany situation, where the East Germans aren't, some East Germans are a little bit concerned about the USSR using them as a piece on their big board game, and the West Germans feel like the US are doing the same to them. So I thought there was an element of that. And I thought it was interesting that the premise of the film is that there's somebody in North Korea more mental than the current leader, who, if they were in charge, things would get really fucking batshit. And it's like, wow, if there's someone more mental than him, then you do have problems, you know? But it's mainly an opportunity to put these two characters in a situation where people from opposing sides of a conflict have to work together. One of whom's more a man of action, and the other one's like very much drives a desk. What did you think of like the buddy element these two people get thrown together?
Yeah, I thought it was quite interesting. Just
the bit where he takes him to a noodle house and goes, "Yeah, this is the food we have here," and the guy has about five portions because he really hasn't had much to eat in a very long time.
Yeah. Sort of tongue in cheek for something that's quite a serious issue in North Korea, but
yeah, I mean, there was an element the South Korean, you know, political advisor, he sometimes acts like comic relief sometimes, and the North Korean guy is very, very, very serious and deadpan, and the North Koreans have their own kind of level of what this tone is okay for our audience because they live with this every day, so they can cope with a bit of levity in with the action, you know, maybe.
Yeah,
but I mean, the opening's pretty striking, isn't it? Where the helicopter gunships and drop these steel rain missiles on and like blow everybody up. Well mounted action. Did you think that was good?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
When that happened, what do you think about the balance between that and the Cold War suspense? Were you expecting more of that type of action, or did you feel like there was a what did you think of the balance between that and like the escalating suspense? Because you have a bit of both, and it's not full on action, it's not full on Cold War espionage. Did that work out for you, that balance?
I think so. I think they were trying to navigate this sort of keeping it kind of grounded and not too far fetched because they're trying to pose the what if question. But also balance it with, you know, if things escalated, this is probably how it would go.
Yeah, and to your point, they're saying they do actually have an escalation when missiles get fired, and I don't want to spoil the plot because there's still a few things that can happen once missiles get fired. You've all seen movies, folks. But it's that kind of film that says, yeah, we're not just going to have a countdown and then everybody breathes a sigh of relief at the end. This could get really fucked up, and there's some pretty serious action here, and you can't trust anyone. And I remember speaking up to you about the shootout in the hospital. I thought the shootout in the hospital was fucking brilliant. Basically, SWAT teams, armed police from South Korea are going in. Some sort of armed unit from the North Korean coup are going in to try and kill the leader and kill any witnesses. And the North Korean spy guy, he's injured. He's got a dependency on drugs, and there's a reason behind that. I don't want to spoil. And he's, you know, using his last bit of energy to kind of fight people off, and he's a really kind of, you know, he's the guy who fights the fight no one else is prepared to. He'll fuck you up. What did you think of that shootout? Did I overhype it to you, or did you think it was good?
Yeah, I thought it was good. I thought, given the budget the film had, they did very well.
So overall, your thoughts, did you enjoy this? Did you enjoy how this all played out?
Yeah. I thought it was a pretty solid film.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that as well. I think, you know, South Korean, you know, we're not these, you know, gatekeepers of like an unknown like movie industry that if we tell you something's good, you're going to find a classic you've never heard of. Great, great South Korean films get heard about, like Old Boy and all of these things. And Parasite is one, you know, Best Picture, and Park Chan-wook and Bong Joon-ho are well known. So it's a, you know, hidden gems are often, occasionally hidden gems are all-time great movies like Blowout, the first episode we ever did, but often a hidden gems like this, which is like, this is a good movie, you should watch it, and you haven't, you know, haven't heard of it, because I can tell a lot of people have seen it. This is one to say, yeah, good film, get watched, especially if you like, you know, a Cold War espionage sort of suspense thriller, but with some decent action thrown in, right?
Yeah.
Now for the one that got away, where we dig deeper into cinematic history for stories of potentially great films that top directors tried and failed to bring to the screen. We look at what happened, why it didn't work out, and what it might have been like if they'd been able to realise their vision. This month we look at a legendary figure from East Asian cinema whose much anticipated foray into international filmmaking failed to materialise despite huge interest. The one that got away for issue 46 is Wong Kar-wai's The Lady from Shanghai. So, James, what do you know about Wong Kar-wai, the filmmaker?
Nothing. I've not heard of anything until we started doing our research on this this feature, basically.
Yeah, so for me, Wong Kar-wai himself as a filmmaker is kind of a one that got away in and of himself. Very, very few of his films are on streaming, apart from two. A cobbled together Western version, I say Western, like Holly, you know, version aimed at Western audiences of one of his earlier films, Ashes of Time, because the original print was lost and they've kind of put that together. And his last big sort of feature film before he moved into doing some TV and stuff called The Grand Master, which was yet another film about Ip Man. Have you seen Ip Man with Donnie Yen?
No.
So he's the famous kind of kung fu master of the 30s, 40s, and even 50s. He actually taught Bruce Lee and was like probably the last big name kind of. He's the purveyor of Wing Chun Kung Fu, which is the most commonly known kung fu in his country. Donnie Yen's done about four films about his life. And I think it's one of those ones where they were competing to do, you know, films, and Wong Kar-wai did one as well. There's a lot of movies about this guy. But other than that, his the films that made his reputation aren't on streaming. You have to buy some very expensive DVDs or Blu-rays to watch the films that he's known for. In the Mood for Love, Chungking Express, Happy Together, 2046, Days of Being Wild. But he's hugely written about. Film buffs all talk about Wong Kar-wai. In the Mood for Love is regarded, you know, makes a lot of like top 10 or top 50 lists. And I know you weren't the biggest fan of Everything Everywhere All at Once, but you know there's some bits in that where one of the parallel lives that Michelle Yeoh could have been leading is the one where she's like a movie star.
Yes.
And Ke-Hu Kwan is her husband / ex-husband, and she's in a movie star like gown, and he's looking very suave in a suit and all of that with his hair slicked back. That is their little tribute to Wong Kar-wai. You know, that's the beautiful cinematography, the mood, the style. He's a critical darling. His films are beautiful to look at. I've seen the films of his that I can get hold of, and I'm not paying like hundreds of pounds for, a Wong Kar-wai collection, you know, but I do try and watch his films and I can see them. His films are not necessarily going to be for everyone, but beautiful to look at. And what I would say about his last film, The Grand Master, this is someone who's prepared to do thriller type stuff, action type stuff, when it's called for in the movie. Because The Grand Master it's been cut together slightly differently for Western audiences, but it's Tony Leung, it's Chang Ziyi, the guy's a kung fu master, so he has kung fu fights. There's the war with Japan, it is built. So the guy could do a thriller, and the guy could do a movie aimed at Western audiences. So I'm not entirely surprised that he was interested in getting into an international film. And this one was going to be with Nicole Kidman in the early 2000s. She was at her height. I think this film got announced just after she won her Oscar. and she was at the same time going looking for different films to do. She did some Lars von Trier stuff in Europe. She's trying to do different stuff as well as big, you know, movie star stuff. And the idea was that this was going to be a bit of a spy thriller set in 20 Shanghai, when you've got the Russians and the British and all sorts of international influence in the city. China's a very interesting place back then. Nicole Kim's a kind of Hitchcockian heroine. Wong Kar-wai described the character who's writing as a dangerous woman who's in danger. That's interesting. She has a romance with a Chinese spy that could get them both in trouble. She's a fish out of water in China. There are international tensions escalating, and she's caught up in a situation she's got to get out of. I'm not, you know, the biggest fan of Nicole Kidman, but only because I don't think she's a little bit overrated for all the awards that she's won. But I would have to say she's usually good in everything she's in, and I would certainly have watched this film if it had been made. What did you find out about this? This is pretty obscure. Did you find out much when you went looking?
Yeah, I read a couple of interviews that he did back in 2003 or 2004 when it was in the pipeline, and he basically talks about Nicole Kidman and saying, you know, this is why I chose her. I think she'd be an excellent choice. And then who's going to cast as the baddie type thing. But then it just sort of fell flat.
As far as I can see, actual work was done to try and get the film going. A script exists. Kidman did actually sign on, and people had meetings to design costumes and scout locations. That amount of filmmaking happened, right? It's not like one of these films where they start shooting and it gets cancelled, like when we did Bruce Willis and Broadway Brawler. There's a lot of speculation and rumour around this film, because Wong Kar-wai is this kind of, you know, again, critical darling. Everyone sort of watches everything that he does and thinks of making. And it's hard to know what was really going on. Was it going to be a remake of the Orson Welles film from the 1940s? No, it turns out. Was Hugh Jackman going to co-star? No, Hugh Jackman said no, because if that was anything more than rumour, he'd been on a plane to China immediately. Do you know what I mean? But so that was circulated in the papers, and Hugh Jackman said, no, I haven't heard anything, but, you know, Wong Kar-wai, call me. Do you know what I mean? There was rumours that Rachel Weisz was either going to be in the film as well or take over as a star when it hit difficulties. Rumour after rumour. There was this talk about, oh, maybe she's too tall for her male co-star, because Tony Leung is about 5'7". It's like, do you remember this woman who was married to Tom Cruise? She stood next to shorter men before. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What it really comes down to is that Wong Kar-wai was notorious for taking a long time to make his films. He took about 5 years to make his last film, The Grand Master, which came out in 2013. Nobody knows if he's going to do another film. He's been working on a TV series in China instead recently. It took him so long to do The Grand Master that they'd done at least two Ip Man films with Donnie Yen before his film about Ip Man came out. He's one of those people who just takes ages to make his films. He doesn't like writing a whole script. He likes to kind of have an outline and then improvise. He agonizes over every detail. He's one of them, right? There are movie makers like that. And Nicole Kidman's a big star in the 2000s. And when a shooting date gets delayed because Wong Kar-wai needs more time, Nicole Kidman goes and makes like two other films, yeah? And then she gets married and decides to have a kid. And it's like, okay, well, if I'm going to have a kid, I've got to work out what films I'm going to make while I'm pregnant. What kind of films I'm going to make after I have the baby? How much travel do I want to do after I have a kid? Do you know what I mean? And if Wong Kar-wai is going to take years to kind of decide what he's going to do, Nicole Kidman is going to hang on, and then maybe the shooting date is now a year later or 2 years later, because she can't just wait forever, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what happened. It got postponed again in 2006. They said it was going to be done again in 2007, but then he went and did another English language film called My Blueberry Nights, which is kind of a... He sometimes does these anthology films where there are different stories that are sort of interconnected. I think Chungking Express is one of those. And that film didn't go very well. I mean, maybe he was trying to do that movie to build his profile up in the West. If that film goes well, people will go, oh, terrific, let's get his other movie out. And in the end, it just didn't work out. By late 2007, Kidman was saying she wasn't prepared to spend a year in China to make a film. She just got married. She was talking about other stuff. Wong Kar-wai by 2008 was still talking about making the film. So maybe it was still a possibility, but, you know, it just got less and less likely the longer things went on, right? There were some interesting rumours. There were stories that Takeshi Kitano was going to be in it, who you know from Takeshi's Castle and Battle Royale, obviously. Tony Leung from, you know, Hero, Infernal Affairs, everything, and, you know, Hard Boiled. He was, you know, there was talk of him being, he was the male co-star they thought might be too short for him. And Gong Li, who is another kind of Chinese actress who is in quite a few Wong Kar-wai films, and as a result, everyone in Hollywood wants to work with them. I mean, Michael Mann made some rather odd plot changes to Miami Vice so that she could play a Cuban in his movie. I mean, that's too long a story to tell now. But these are actors I'd like to watch in movies. Like, do you remember when we were talking about Hero, mate?
Yes.
And it's like, it's not just that Hero's quite a good film in and of itself. It's like, look at all the fucking people that are in it. Do you know what I mean? And Wong Kar-wai is the sort of person who assembles those casts where you go, oh, great, you know, I'd like to see those people in that movie. But then he goes off and does The Grandmaster, which took him 5 years, and he hasn't done a film since, and it never happened. I mean, as an idea, I mean, are you interested in this kind of movie? Do you like films set in, like, 1920s China with a bit of intrigue going on? Would you watch that if they'd actually managed to put it together?
I mean, I've never seen a film set in 1920s China. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, China as we know it now is kind of this big monolithic kind of country that stretches from, you know, a border with Russia all the way across to, you know,
Pakistan.
And everything, yeah. With a communist government in charge of all of it. In 1920s, it was split into a million pieces. There was, you know, different regions, different factions, warlords, so many things going on. And because of where China is, the Russians have an interest, the Americans have an interest, the Japanese have an interest, the British have an interest because they're in Hong Kong. There's lots going on there. The challenges with something like this, what do you think of when foreign filmmakers who are very successful making a certain kind of film in a certain market, whether it's, you know, Germany, France, Japan, Korea, wherever, what do you think about when they come across and make a movie in Hollywood? How well do you think that works?
I think it depends. I think it needs to be done carefully.
Yeah. I mean, for example, when John Woo did Face Off, it was like, we're ready to do the John Woo thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when John Woo did Mission Impossible 2, it's like it was a bit of a mismatch between what those movies are meant to be and what a John Woo film's meant to be. And not apportioning any blame, but there is sometimes an element of when these filmmakers come across to Hollywood, it's like, we've hired you because of all the things that you do, and now we're not going to let you do what you do.
Right, yeah.
And sometimes it works. I mean, Bong Joon-ho's done all right with his international films. Okja is very popular. Snowpiercer is very popular, although it is notable he had a really hard time filming Snowpiercer. He had a lot of struggles with, I think all the people who worked on the film loved it, you know, Tilda Swinton and Chris Evans and all these people, they're very professional and that was all fine, but he had a lot of struggles with the people he was making the film for, and that film was delayed for a year. I think the way this one would probably work best is actually still a Chinese film, but I think it's better if Nicole Kidman travels there to make the movie rather than Wong Kar-wai tries to come to the West to make a movie. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Because he assembles his films in a certain way, and the films of his that I've seen, it is about beautiful cinematography and mood and style, and he sometimes tells the story in quite an unconventional way, and what the character's really about unfolds. There might be a flashback, there might be parallel stories to tell you what's going on. If you're going to do that, you have to let the director cook. You know, you can't have a producer going, oh, hang on, you know, no, I don't think you should do it that way. And what one of the criticisms of The Grandmaster is that Harvey Weinstein, yes, fucking him again, made Wong Kar-wai recut his film The Grandmaster for a Western audience, and it's got, they move the scenes around to be a bit more chronological and have lots of interstitial subtitles going, and then the Japanese invaded and World War II happened. It's like, yeah, thanks, Harvey, you fat prick, you know? So I think Wong Kar-wai's got to make his movie and Nicole Kidman's got to go to China to make it. Could it happen now? What do you think about when a director hasn't made a movie in 10 years and looks like he's off doing other things?
Yeah, then it's a bit, you're sort of hesitant, aren't you?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, there are people saying that Wong Kar-wai's reputation is built on films that are at least 15 years old.
Yeah.
And maybe it's like, we love, you know, you if you love those films, that's fine, but there are no examples of those films still being made, right? If he was going to do it, the person who wrote in and said, Margot Robbie, that's a fucking tremendous idea, because she's got the juice to make a film like this happen, right? And as far as I can see, she's doing a very good job managing her career. So if she made a decision to make to work with an international filmmaker like this, she could make it happen. And I think I'd like to see her in that kind of movie. I mean, I find this kind of period really interesting. 1920s, 30s. Well, and one of my favourite things about The Grandmaster, the Wong Kar-wai film that I have seen, is that it is set in a Chinese city in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and all of that stuff. It's a different world, you know. It's a different world to watch a story unfolding, you know. If you want to know what this would look like, well, if you're lucky or rich enough to own any Wong Kar films on disc, watch them. You'll see what the cinematography would have been like. If you look at the early period scenes from The Last Emperor, when, you know, especially the ones where he's like an international playboy in Shanghai, I think you would get a flavour of the 20s and 30s kind of world that this could have been set in. But yeah, I don't think this is going to happen now. Someone should do a movie like this, though. Someone should try out this idea, because I think it would be pretty good. We close the features episode with the remake Hate Watch. This is where we shine a light on the lack of originality in the Hollywood boardroom and their obsession with remaking, rebooting, reimagining, or just plain recycling older films. Quite often this is our chance to let off steam and rant at a terrible and unworthy remake which sullies the reputation of an old classic. But every now and again the new film holds up under our ruthless examination and emerges from the Hate Watch with some credit. Spoiler alert, not this time. Later on, we will also discuss a remake restoration. Once we've finished asking if one remake was unnecessary and should be removed, we'll suggest instead a remake that should happen because it needs to be done right this time. Our theme this month, as we said, is Asian cinema, particularly East Asian cinema, but we're bending the rules ever so slightly for this one as we discuss an American film which is an English language version of a classic Asian film. In this case, it was the seriously unwise decision to do a remake of one of the all-time great Korean films, by the master director Park Chan-wook. The remake Hate Watch for issue 47 is Spike Lee's reboot of Old Boy. So, Old Boy, I think we're both fans of the original, yes?
Yep, I watched the original and watched 5 minutes of the remake for this because I felt like that was adequate. Adequate watching to discuss this. The original's just bonkers. It's just gritty. It's a great film. There's nothing really else to be said about it.
It takes you to places you just didn't realise it was possible to take people in a movie, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the big question on this is why? Why the fuck did anyone think this was a good idea? I mean, we can talk briefly about how they get it wrong in the movie when they actually make it, but we knew they were going to get it wrong before they even shot at 1 foot of film, right? Why did they even bother?
Just to kind of ride on the coattails, I think.
But, you know, normally the reason you do a remake is, you know, is money, right? It's money or creative, right? Creative remakes are, I do genuinely think, Martin Scorsese with The Departed, and which is an English language remake of an Asian classic, right? It was only a few years later. In a lot of ways, I still think that's not necessary. But I do think Scorsese found a movie that he wanted to make based on that story, right? This isn't, I don't know what's going on, it's not suited to the director. It's, you know, the original film doesn't have this like massive ready and waiting audience. The other thing is, right, The Departed is suited to the director, right? That you could see a Scorsese crime film about a guy who goes undercover. I get it, right? Also, Infernal Affairs, that Departed is a remake of, it's the sort of story that if it hadn't already happened and you pitched it to a Hollywood studio, they would want to make it. Not Old Boy. If Old Boy didn't exist and someone went in and said, I want to do a movie about the story of Old Boy, no fucking Hollywood studio in the world would make it. So it's not going to make money, and there isn't a creative reason to do this. I genuinely don't think Spike Lee went, I've seen Old Boy and I've got, there's something about this story that I want to do. This is clearly a gig for everybody involved. So I just don't know why they did it. Because this isn't like a big money-making exercise and it's not a creatively satisfying exercise. I like the actors involved. I like Spike Lee. This was going to fail no matter what. Probably it would have failed even worse with the original idea. I don't know if you heard about this. Spielberg had fancied doing it with Will Smith in the main role.
No, I didn't hear about that.
But it's just like, they don't get it. No one involved in this, I don't really saw from 5 minutes, but no one involved in this movie gets what made the original film great. And that doesn't surprise me that they didn't. What did you think of the 5 minutes you saw?
It's just fucking boring.
I mean, again, I think the remake restoration that we're going to do is a little bit more interesting. That here's what they've done wrong. Doing it in the first place, right? Doing it with a director who's not suited to it. Not having a version of this story that they wanted to tell. I mean, you know, here's my little hobby horse, but The Departed is an American-Irish Catholic interpretation of themes of lying, betrayal, you know, being a rat, you know, being a mole, all of that stuff, you know. And in Infernal Affairs is the Hong Kong Chinese kind of Buddhist version of that, of living with the guilt and being and betraying the people that you care about, all of that stuff. I see it. There's none of that here. There's no reason to do this movie. They've gone all in for gore. I don't know if you saw some of the gory attempts, someone gets shot with a shotgun, all this stuff. But the darkness and sheer perversity of the original is downplayed. They don't go all in on the ending. You know, they've got the usual dilemma. If you do it like the original, why did you bother doing a new film? If you change it, will it be as good? And the answer is no, it doesn't. There's no character development. Why is Elizabeth Olsen's character bothered? I get that in the original, not in this. You remember the corridor fights in An Old Boy? Pivotal scene, been stolen from so many times.
Yes.
They totally replaced that in this. I don't know if you watched that bit. It's not a corridor. It's a big, wide open space. And it's like, did you not see the fucking original movie? Do you not get why that scene works in the original? It's in a tight space. It's so obviously not going to work when it's a big, wide area and Josh Brolin is kind of fighting people in a different way. Doesn't make sense. The whole thing is completely, you know, just weak. Anything that even remotely begins to work is because, you know, they do what the original did. But it doesn't work in America. It doesn't work with these characters. It doesn't work with this director. It doesn't work in a Hollywood system that's not prepared to really commit to this, what this story is really about. It's fucking bollocks. It's bollocks.
Yeah, I mean, it is shite.
So, yeah, be warned. I mean, the one person who had anything positive to say about this film is the person who'd never seen the original before Old Boy came out. And that's what these movies are always about, aren't they? See if we can catch someone who's not seen the original, basically. But honestly, if you think Old Boy is a story that interests you, a man is in prison for 20 years and then gets let out suddenly and has to find out why, and when he finds out why, he wishes he hasn't because it's a horrifying story, okay? Watch it Korean style, because we've said it before, we'll say it again, the Koreans know their shit, okay? They know this stuff, they do this stuff. End of story, you know? Instead, the remake restoration, the film we'd like to redo. This is very much one for me. And what were your thoughts when I said to you, I'd like to remake an old shitty ninja film from the 1980s? When I said that's what we're going to talk about, what were your thoughts on that, mate? Why do you think I'm interested in this?
Yeah, I think it's because it means a lot to you. That's probably why.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a big thing from my youth. What are your thoughts on ninjas generally? Ninjas as a concept. Is that something that you've grown up thinking, oh, ninjas, cool?
Yeah, they're pretty cool, but like we said sort of at the start, they've been really poorly done.
Yeah, general rule of thumb. Ninjas are awesome. Most films about ninjas are generally shit. There are some exceptions. The anime Ninja Scroll, which a listener talked about, that's a good movie. There's a couple of films with Scott Adkins where his character is a ninja, and Scott Adkins is an incredible martial artist. His films are worth watching just for his fight scenes. He's a decent actor. You know, he's the guy in the fat suit in John Wick 4, yeah?
Yes.
So I'll watch his stuff, but those aren't really ninja films. They're Scott Adkins films where he fights people and occasionally dresses as a ninja. It's fine. And there's a film called Ninja Assassin, which I've got a soft spot for, even though it's not really all that good. The rest of the time, every now and again, you get ninjas getting used in films that aren't actually ninja films. Like Batman Begins, basically what Ra's al Ghul is doing, he's training an army of ninjas, right? More or less.
Yeah.
And You Only Live Twice. And there's a TV show on Netflix at the moment, House of Ninjas, which is pretty good. On the whole, though, ninjas are shit. I mean, have you seen many ninja films, especially the ninja films of the 80s? This must be like a whole kind of different world to you.
Yeah, no, I've not really seen many ninja films, and they've never been done very well in the ones that I've seen, and I wouldn't really count Batman Begins, because it's, yes, they are ninjas, but that's not the kind of plot point.
No, Batman, that, you know, it's like, oh, it's interesting, where would Batman learn those kinds of skills? That's an interesting way for Nolan to do the origin story instead of all the same kind of, like, plot points that you normally get in a Batman origin story. We get it, it's fine, but it's not a ninja film, obviously. The reason this worked out is that there was a bit of a craze for martial arts films when I was a kid. And a lot of it was, you know, in the 80s, your martial arts characters were, you know, in the early 80s, especially Chuck Norris. You got to see a little bit of Jackie Chan. Bruce Lee was obviously the mainstay, but he didn't do that many films. And by the time you're watching those films in the 80s, they do look very cheesy. You know, the set cheesy in 70s, right? We'll never get to see Bruce Lee is the Jimi Hendrix of martial arts films, right? The stuff he did was brilliant. We'll never see what he would have done if he'd had more time, you know?
Yep.
And then, you know, later on you get the likes of, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme and these other kind of martial arts people. Ninjas were the like the coolest, the darkest, the stuff that, you know, when people heard about ninjas, you know, you don't have the internet back then, but people hear about, oh, look at this article on ninjas. They really existed. They didn't really exist the way you see them in films, but, you know, whatever. Look at these ninja stars that they had. You throw them and they kind of embedded in the wall. And like one absolute nutball at my school actually managed to get hold of a ninja star and used to throw it at walls and stuff. So there's a bit of a craze for it at the time. And it's like darker and more dangerous. There was one guy who's good, and he's in this Revenge of the Ninja film. Did you find Revenge of the Ninja to watch? It's not very easy to find.
No, I didn't.
So the main character is a guy called Sho Kasugi. I would describe his acting skills as sort of adequate in the way that, you know, someone like Chuck Norris can walk in, not fall over the furniture, but he's not going to win any Oscars, that kind of thing. Yeah. He's terrific at the martial arts and he is an actual practitioner of ninjutsu. So he can do the kind of moves with the sword and everything. The original Revenge of the Ninja is very crude and silly because it's canon, because it's from the same people that were doing, you know, Missing in Action and the Octagon and all of those things. Right. You do get some actual ninja action. You get proper martial arts fights at times and a bit of gore. The reason I want to do this, I just want to see a top line version of that. I want to see some, you know, a film packed with people who actually know what they're doing to do a story about ninjas. You could do it in a historical setting. You could do it in a modern day setting. I do like the idea of like ninjas are here in the West, but you don't know about it. Do you know what I mean? And then the clash of one ninja, you know, a good one and a bad one behind some plot. You know, I'm up for that. But it's just about doing it in a less hokey way. You know, because the fun is, right, ninjas are a historical fact because the samurai class, there were things that the respectable classes of Japan weren't supposed to do because they were considered dishonorable, you know, concealing yourself, sending assassins on the quiet to kill people. And instead of not doing them, they just got a bunch of low-class people and trained them to do it instead and pretended it wasn't happening, which is a very Japanese thing to do. But it's the same thing here, right? We have people that do the dirty work and we don't like to admit it. They're those guys.
Yeah.
And the fun is, oh, they didn't do all that wild stuff, did they? You know, they didn't have like almost supernatural abilities because of how well they were trained. They didn't have the bit where they kind of just throw a flashbang on the ground and when the smoke clears, they've disappeared. How do they do it? Do you know what I mean? Or maybe, or did they? Maybe they did, you know? That's the fun of one of those movies. I just like to see someone who's really, really good do this kind of thing. I could have picked other ninja films. I mean, the other ones that were done with this guy, there's a film called Enter the Ninja, which is about a white guy who's a ninja who goes to Japan. That's kind of the Scott Atkins movies that they've done already. There's Nine Deaths of the Ninja, which is very good. I just like the title. They did a series of movies called American Ninja, which are fucking dog shit. This one does at least have this basic plot engine, which is to say, this guy is a fully fledged ninja. He's left Japan because there were so many infighting, you know, between sort of rival kind of businesses, and his family were killed, and he's come here to start again. But it seems like someone who is also a ninja is doing something. There's an import export business from Japan. There's dodgy stuff going on. It looks like a ninja is killing people to cover up criminal activity. He's got to investigate. He's got to go back to this kind of life that he left behind. And you have, you know, battles between ninjas in a Western setting. I think that's a perfectly decent setting for a movie. I'd just like to see it come to life, you know? I think you could have someone like Scott Atkins in there, not as the main character, but maybe as a Westerner who knows martial arts and believes something is going on and gets involved. He's very good for a tremendous fight scene. But the lead should be a Japanese person. And I've probably said this before, but Takashi Miike, he's done loads of different films, and one or two of his films have got some awesome, like, samurai-style action, like 13 Assassins, Blade of the Immortal, and the Dead or Alive series. You know, maybe it's a Japanese film where Japanese characters come to America, so he keeps a bit of, like, creative control over the film, like Black Rain in reverse. If someone did, like, a, an A-list film about ninjas, would you watch that, mate? Would you be interested? Or am I? Is this only for people my age who wished that their childhood had better movies?
With the right story, director, and cast, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
But that's obviously the three of the hardest things to do when making a film. So.
What is it about these that means that no one's ever done this? Is it just because ninjas are too trashy as a concept? Does it mean no one serious is ever going to do this? Christopher Nolan's never going to make a film about the history of ninjas, is he?
I don't know if it's necessarily because it's trashy. I just maybe the people just aren't interested. Like, I think maybe these things come and go, and maybe the ninja films are just one of those ones. Pirate films, for example, nobody cares about pirate films anymore. But from 2003 to 2015, everyone wanted to see the new Pirates of the Caribbean film. So maybe if it was done right, people would be interested, but it's hard to say, really.
Yeah, I mean, what makes me hopeful is, again, the TV series House of Ninjas, which is on Netflix right now. I know I'm about to tell you Netflix's viewing figures, which is total bullshit, right? They never tell the complete story. But of the figures that Netflix have released about their viewings, House of Ninjas is the worldwide number two show on its non-English language TV programs. So it's not quite Squid Game, but it's been watched by a lot of people. It also made the top 10 viewing figures among all of their content in 71 countries around the world. So it is being watched. People are interested in it. There's a couple of people in there who would be the right age and profile to be the main character. If one of them fancied playing the main character, you know, in this, they can clearly do it because I've watched the movie and their, you know, martial arts action is really good. So it feels like it could be done. And I would just like to see it. I mean, I've got my own ideas for like ninja stories, but I'm not gonna give them away here. But I'd like to see this. And if someone just did something like that Revenge of the Ninjas basic storyline, but top line, I think it would find an audience, especially if you put a couple of decent like martial arts names in it. That's why you get Scott Atkins, because he brings an audience with him. But yeah. This is one for the oldies, I think. This is one for people my age who wish that we'd got something better back in the day. That's all for this month's Double Reel Features. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to my co-host, James Adamson.
The music was Mistake the Getaway by Kevin MacLeod.
Steel Rain is available to stream worldwide on Netflix.
The story of Wong Kar-wai's The Lady of Shanghai is told in Simon Braun's book, The Greatest Movies You'll Never See, as well as some detailed articles on fan site wongkarwai.net.
Tune in next week for The Big Conversation, where we'll be discussing how the 2024 Oscars went down.
We look forward to speaking to you then. Take care in the meantime.